It is a strange war that doesn't do things to languages. And one of the interesting byproducts of World War II is a series of expressions that appeared in England. For instance, Americans will undoubtedly soon be endeavoring to fit scran, choker, and wizard into their own speech. In World War II, a rookie is no longer a rookie. He is an irk. Nothing is ever bad.
He is irked.
He is irked, right.
That's all that's left of him after the bombshell. All I found was his irk, which is, you know, which is, right? Which is the neck without an end.
With a little metal on it.
A little metal on it, right?
It's a knife without a handle.
Knife without a handle and his neck without an end. And an irk. And narcs are guys that go around doing that now, and it's legal.
That's right. Nothing is ever bad. It is ropey.
Ropey?
Right. And a ropey job is likely as not to be a blonde who proved uncollaborative.
Uncollaborative.
You know what collaboration means? I keep assuming a lot of people don't know these words. Yeah, that's what you get your hair shaved for being a collaborator, baby. That means you and the...
This was 1942.
The schnacker.
Sophia Loren got lots of mileage out of making movies like that.
Anything that turns out badly...
Collaboration!
Yeah.
Vittorio De Sica. Right.
You know, I've noticed...
Sophia Loren.
Lorenzo Bicycle.
Right.
I've noticed that you hold your breath when you smoke a normal cigarette. Anything that turns out badly, whether
how
it be...
How do you know this is a normal cigarette?
That's a normal cigarette. How do you like the taste, Phil?
It's wonderful. And it doesn't upset my stomach.
A soldier is never fed up to the teeth. He's browned off or brassed off. When army things are under control, they're buttoned up. Otherwise, they may be cheesed.
Cheese.
That's where hard cheese comes from. Hard cheese. Terry
hard cheese. Right, that man's. There's a cryogenics concern in Glendale now called Solid Jackson.
Really?
That's right, man.
Sleeping and zizzing.
Is that true?
That's true.
Sleeping.
That's right next to that big pond of fish head.
Listen.
Olympic in the moonlight.
Okay.
Oh, I see.
I see. No, DC.
The two stories sort of tend to corroborate each other. Right?
They collaborate.
Or collaborate.
Right. Right. The schnacker told them to.
Oh, you said it.
No, I didn't. Oh, I said right. The schnacker.
Anyway, wait a minute. I don't think it's schnacker. I think we got another word for this. Yeah, the word this time is, let's see, stupor. That was
no, not stupor.
No, that was two weeks ago.
Stupor is what you get in if you're stupor.
Yeah, the Agnew.
The Agnew?
The Agnew.
The Agnew is the name?
Oh, yeah.
He's number two.
So don't mention the little, the little
Agnew.
Now, here's some language that'll probably tickle the fancy of a lot of the girls out there in the audience. This is the language that came from the lips of the pert young wrens, as the blue uniform girls of the Women's Royal Naval Service are called. You probably remember that, Annalie. When a wren
says...
They
cut their hair to make wigs for enemy agents, you know. That's right.
When a wren says, I mustn't be adrift too late, or else the jaunty will put me in the rattle and the bloke will give me a bottle. She means... I must return from leave on time, or the master at arms will bring me before the commanding officer for a lecture.
For electron, actually. Right.
When Jenny the Wren is fed up with the world, she is chukka. And when she grumbles, she's guilty of dripping. Sleeping is zizzing, whether it's on the job or in the hammock.
Are you zizzing or dripping, dear?
Our chukka.
I'm all cheesed off.
To the wren, her sailor boyfriend is a killick, or if he's a soldier, he's a pungo.
Pungo! Oh, you're dripping again.
Crushers are male or female petty officers.
Oh, you're zizzing. Oh, well, take a look at this.
This chukka last week. I was cheesed off, so I jumped at her.
When a sweetheart or companion in the Navy is an oppo.
Oh, yeah.
An oppo.
Oppo, oppo.
When a wren, killick, or battleship is dressed up, she, he, or it is tiddly. And when a sailor goes on leave, he goes up the line. I'm going up the line with a dripping broad.
Get me some tiddly.
A parachute is not a parachute, but a brolly. The rear gunner's turret is the dustbin. A coastal command plane is a kipper kite. The bomb-dropping mechanism is a Mickey Mouse.
No, and Mickey Moused.
Oh, Mickey missed. And the automatic pilot is George.
Hi, George.
A fighter pilot climbs into the pulpit of his plane and pulls the greenhouse.
Does
cockpit.
What? Does what? Climbs,
he climbs
into, the
into the pulpit of his plane.
Ready for the flash, Pastor?
Yeah, all right. And pulls the greenhouse cockpit cover over him when he's off to hunt a solid lump of blitz. He's off
dripping
to hunt
blitz.
A solid lump of blitz.
The copper kite gave me some dripping blints.
Which is enemy,
right.
Enemy
that's
formation.
Not right, is it?
Waiting in the air for a Junker Schmidt to appear, he snakes about or plays pussy in the clouds. Then he screams downhill and sends the German into the drink with a quickie.
Can you believe it?
You couldn't put those words together on the air without being lewd.
Each month, a few outstanding pilots polish their buttons and go to Buckingham Palace to collect a gong. No flyer spares his contempt for the penguins, the non-flying administrative officers in the RAF. Everything is a type in the RAF, and all flyers take views. If a girl has good lines, she may be a pucker type. But a Heinkel pilot who shoots too soon or runs for home is definitely a poor type or just a pleep. A pilot takes an outside view of Berlin when the air over the Nazi capital is full of flak and crickets, German night fighters, but when a weekend with no operations and a Saturday night party has been laid on, the view is definitely wizard.
Wizard. And it takes a wizard.
Hot cheese. Hot cheese. The hot cheese.
She's a pucker type.
Yeah, right.
Good-o.
Pongo. Pongo. Zzz, drip, 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 drip. What a war. What a war.
Hot cheese. Hot cheese.
Far out.
Far out.
Far out. Shakespeare is represented as a sort of divine sponge. Let's have
all mankind could be packed into a box a half mile on each side.
Hot cheese.
Hot cheese. Hot cheese. Right on. Book is at 5 o'clock. Book is at 5 o'clock. And a rebroadcast of this show, friends, at 6.
You're tiddly.
Okay, I've got something I'd like to read here. Very short, but very interesting.
Okay, Pete.
This is from this week's New Yorker, and it's a little article about American Indians in Los Angeles. And it's not a very interesting article, except there's one little part right near the end. And it's talking now about a meeting that was called out at UCLA or something like that on how to get to know Indians and the people that came. Montoya later, Montoya's an Indian, got into a more serious argument with a white man in Western clothes who had come to the meeting with an Indian businessman. The white man, who introduced himself as a colonel, said that everyone ought to do his part for Indians and presented a project that he was undertaking as his contribution. He planned to lead a group of young Indians on horseback from the Mexican border to Canada, a journey that would allow them to learn horsemanship, to study their culture at reservations along the way, and to appear in the Calgary Stampede when they arrived in Canada. Montoya seemed to recognize the colonel after the project was explained, and he asked angrily if it was the same scheme that had been offered to the Negroes and turned down, and whether the plan called for some of the Indians to wear cavalry uniforms. The colonel did not exactly answer either question. How much money is going to be made off of it, Montoya asked. I wouldn't know, the colonel said, looking wounded. But you are going to make some money. I hope so, the colonel said. Etc., etc., etc.
100 years ago today. This is 100 years ago today then. From the April 1870 issue of Harper's Magazine.
Suck it to me.
In this brief sketch, the writer has striven to give a chapter out of the history of the Indians in America in the belief that it will point the way to the safe solution of the Indian question. Let Congress at once legislate so that all matters concerning the Indians shall be placed under the supervision of the War Department. Subordinate agents, similar to the Quakers who are now in service at Fort Cobb, may be appointed, but they should act under the immediate direction of military authority. Give to the Indians sugar and coffee, furnish them with plows and seeds, but let them at once and forever understand that the hand that feeds can, and if need be, will, strike. The benefits of the arts of peace may be taught the red man, but the saving grace of our reform movement is the iron fingers in a velvet glove.
Do you wonder how the Indians felt when they first saw white men? Here's a story telling of some Indians who had never before seen or heard of a white man. Several Indians were one day going through the woods when they came to some trees that were cut in a strange way. At first, they thought it must be the work of beavers, but they saw that this could not be so, for the chips were too large. A beaver could not open his mouth wide enough to cut such big chips. At last, they said, some great underwater animal must have done it. They saw a place where a tree trunk had been cut down and dragged away. They followed this path or trail and soon found footprints of an animal. The footprints did not seem to them like those of men, for there was a deep place at the heel. The Indians did not know that these prints had been made by shoes with heels, for they had never heard of such things. Soon they worked through the brush and saw the animals at work. At first the Indians thought that they were bears. But as they came a little nearer, they thought that perhaps the workers might be men, yet they had hairy faces, a great deal of hair hanging down from their chins. The Indians hid behind trees and watched them. Some of the white men were piling up logs while others were picking up sticks. The Indians were afraid to come nearer. One of the oldest of them said, perhaps they will smell us or feel us here. Perhaps they will kill us. Let us go away. So they went back to their camp. They said, We saw some queer water animals that looked much like people. They had white faces with much hair on them. Some had red bodies, and some were black. The Indians did not know that it was the men's clothing that was red and black.
What's that book?
This is from a book called Stories of Pioneer Life by Florence Bass, published in about 19... for young readers, 1900. Published in 1900. And it ends with, "Have you felt sorry for the Indian because he was driven from his land? Remember that he used it for little except hunting. He raised few crops. He built no cities or roads or bridges. He did not try to make himself better or to learn better ways of living. He left the land no better for the people who lived after him.
There's an Indian here, Bob. We've got to get him off.
Very few people can live, even in a rich country, unless they use the land well. The Indians would not learn from the white men how to improve their land, and so they lost it. What we do not use, we are likely to lose.